So last week Elizabeth walked through Gideon. I'm sure that was fantastic. And I think before we can dive into Abimelech is a unique character in Judges. He is not considered a judge. He's considered the anti-judge. So when, like we talked about the background at the beginning, that there are 12 judges, 6 major, 6 minor, he's the 13th guy. He's not one of the 12. And it's because he basically decides to make himself a king. So he's like stepping outside of even the design of the judge at the time. So he's just a big mess. But even before we like get into his story, the end of Gideon's story really sets the stage for Abimelech. And at the death of Gideon, well, first before his death, the people at the end of chapter 8, Elizabeth probably would have talked about this, but that they told Gideon, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. So they're declaring, Gideon, you rule over us. And then in verse 23, he says to them, which just is right, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. And so he is telling them, like, really, your king is the Lord. Your judge is the Lord, not me. However, we see verse 33 of chapter 8, as soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. Okay, so pretty like, wow, snap of a finger. Okay, we've got the immediate turning, the immediate being given over. And Dale Roth Davis says about this, when we want the thing more than we want the one who provides it, we have fallen prone to the corrupting core of idolatry. So in this, the people wanted, hey, no, come on. The people wanted this immediate, we're just starting. So perfect. We're on like literally the first part here, talking about Abimelech and his coming to power really in compromise of the Lord's design. And so first that the people immediately turned away from Gideon's instruction to have the Lord as their king. But then what we see at the end again of chapter 8, this is still kind of Gideon's story, but we see that immediately the people of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side, and they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal, which is Gideon, in return for all the good that he had done to Israel. And so what we see happen is they don't remember the Lord, and then what's going to happen in this story is that immediately Abimelech is going to basically kill all of Gideon's family, all of them, so that he can be the king. And so there's loss of love for the Lord, which then leads to loss of love for people. They go hand in hand. As you reject the Lord and God as king, you begin to reject people. And Jesus, in teaching the great commandment, he says, "Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law?" And Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." And we really can't love our neighbor as we should apart from loving God. And so we see this downfall is going to happen with the story of Abimelech, first because of loss of love for the Lord, and then in the result of that being loss of love for people. So as we step into Abimelech's story, chapter 9, we're going to kind of look at it in sections. Again, it's a long narrative. But the first 6 verses, verses 1 through 6 of chapter 9, basically just tell us how Abimelech came to power. And basically what he does is he starts whispering into everyone's ears, there's 70 sons of Gideon, because he had so many concubines. You know, just a mess. And he starts whispering, basically saying, like, wouldn't it be best if there was just one of us to rule over everyone? It might be a lot if there's 70, you know. And so he starts enticing the people to agree with him. And so he first is using deception. And then he flat out uses murder and murders all the brothers, all 70, except for one escaped. And we'll get to that person, Joseph. He escaped. But this rise of power of Abimelech really stemmed from Gideon's sin first, that he had all these concubines. Abimelech was the son of one of the concubines. So he wasn't even like a son that could inherit or a son that could come to power or be the king. And his name, Abimelech, means my father is king, which Gideon would have named him. And so Gideon, even though he told us the Lord is going to rule over you, not me, he's then named his son my father is king. So you see this faithlessness of Gideon, this being and the consequences of that being reaped in Abimelech. So then Abimelech's rise to power is, like we said, through corruption, deception, murder. He was not called by God to be a leader. He kind of forced himself into the position by manipulating the people. And then it even says, I love that it describes it like this, but it says, Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows who followed him. That's in verse 4. Worthless and reckless fellows. So he surrounded himself with other awful people. And this is who is about to lead the people in this chapter. So, what's going to happen? what is going to happen? So, like I mentioned, he killed all the sons, yeah, except for one, Joseph. He escaped. And so what we have in verses 7 through 21 is this really interesting satirical fable that Joseph says to the people. And he is speaking it, so they're in Shechem, and Joseph is speaking this fable from Mount Gerizim, is where he is actually declaring the fable from. And I want to kind of unpack what the significance of Shechem and Mount Gerizim are before we dive into the actual fable. But Shechem is the location of where God established the covenant with Abraham in Genesis 12. So we have, it's a very sacred area, the covenant being established there. And we see on your next page, on page 2, I have a picture. It kind of shows you the valley. So Shechem is down in the valley. And then on either side, you have Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And out, the other map is kind of, I made it too small. Sorry about that, guys. But Shechem is kind of written big on the map there, kind of in the middle. But what's interesting about Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal is in Deuteronomy, specifically in chapters 27 and 28, Moses commanded the people in reestablishing the law, or declaring the law and the covenant with the Lord, he had 6 of the tribes go up on Mount Gerizim, and 6 of the tribes go up on Mount Ebal. And from Mount Gerizim, they declared the blessings of the covenant loudly, because you could hear through the valley. And then on Mount Ebal, they declared all the curses of the covenant. And so it was this kind of a ceremony to declare the fullness of the covenant with the Lord. And then even in Joshua, we kind of talked about Joshua before we dove into Judges. But this is where Joshua reestablished the covenant. It says in verse 33 there, and all Israel, sojourner as well as native-born, with their elders and officers and their judges, stood on opposite sides of the ark before the Levitical priests, who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, half of them in front of Mount Gerizim and half of them in front of Mount Ebal, just like what happened in Deuteronomy. Just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded at the first to bless the people of Israel. And so these are pretty significant locations, significant mountains that were used ceremonially to declare the Lord's covenant. And Mount Gerizim specifically was the Mount of Blessing, where the blessings were declared. Now, what's about to happen is Jotham, this one son that escaped the murder of Abimelech, he is going to declare this fable from Mount Gerizim, the Mount of Blessing. And it's not going to be a blessing at all. So I'm going to read verses 7 through 15 first and just kind of hear his sarcasm, Jotham's sarcasm. When it was told to Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and cried aloud and said to them, "Listen to me, you leaders of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went out to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.' But the olive tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my abundance, by which gods and men are honored, and go hold sway over the trees?' And the tree said to the fig tree, 'You come and reign over us.' But the fig tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go hold sway over the trees?' And the tree said to the vine, 'You come and reign over us.' But the vine said to them, 'Shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go hold sway over the trees?' Then all the trees said to the bramble, 'You come and reign over us.' And the bramble said to the trees, 'If in good faith you are anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon.'" Okay, this is what Jotham is declaring from the mountain. So, hey, we want you, fruitful vine, to come be our king. No, don't want to do that. Okay, you olive tree. No, fig tree. No, bramble. Will you come be our king? And the bramble says, "I'll offer you shade." Now, brambles don't offer shade, right? All that a bramble would have been used for at this time is fire. It would have been used for burning. And it would offer no shade, and thus it would be worthless. It would be absolutely worthless. And this is what is being used to satirically describe Abimelech as the king that the people have appointed. They passed over people that would have been fruitful, that would have been good, and instead they have put this worthless bramble. And so it's designed to truly show how ridiculous the people are in having Abimelech as king. Then verses 16 through 21, again, I really love Jotham's sarcasm, this part, because when I read this part, I want you to listen for just how he is saying it in a way. He's not telling them you did wrong. He's like letting them come to the conclusion on their own just by what he's saying. So let's read 16 through 21. "Now therefore, if you acted in good faith and integrity when you made Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house and have done to him as his deeds deserve," so basically, if you had good faith and integrity when you made him king and you didn't do anything wrong to all the sons of Gideon, "for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian. And you have risen up against my father's house this day and have killed his sons, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his female servant, king over the leaders of Shechem, because he is your relative. And if you then have acted in good faith and integrity with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the leaders of Shechem and Beth Millo, and let fire come out from the leaders of Shechem and from Beth Millo and devour Abimelech." And Jotham ran away and fled and went to Beer and lived there because of Abimelech and his brother. So he basically said, if you have acted in good faith and integrity, great. And if you have not, then fire will devour Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. And it's very like, I don't know, I was just kind of taken aback by Jotham as I, and he's declaring this from this Mount of Blessing, Mount Gerizim. It's truly a curse. He's declaring this curse to the people for selecting Abimelech as their leader. Now as we move into the next big chunk, which is going to be verses 22 to 57. I'm not going to read that for you, but what verses 22 through 57 are is the absolute horrible chaos that ensues, the chaos and destruction. And what I want to just bring to your attention is verse 23. And God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. And the leaders of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the violent son of the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother who killed them, and so on. And so we have God sending an evil spirit to basically put enmity between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. And then basically what ensues, after that we don't hear of God at all. We don't hear the name of the Lord mentioned. All that's mentioned is that one verse, he sent an evil spirit. And then the chaos ensues. And I had to make a list of all the chaos. I didn't put it on your handout. But basically what happens in verses 22 through 57 is that first the evil spirit is sent by the Lord to create discord. And then there's this man, Gaal, who comes in trying to seek control of the men of Shechem. And then you got Abimelech's military leader, Zebul, and he's trying to maintain control for Abimelech. So we're about to have this major conflict. Well, Gaal gets driven out. A bunch of people get killed by Abimelech and Zebul. And then Abimelech captures Shechem and completely destroys it. And he doesn't just destroy the city, like, let me tear down all the buildings and set fire. He then pours salt. He salts the ground, which Shechem was one of the most fertile regions in the valley. And the fig tree, the olive tree, the vine, he not only destroys it, but he destroys the ground. Then he burns the tower of Shechem, where all the leaders had fled. There were over 1,000 people in the tower. And that gets completely burned, and everyone dies. And then he decides to just continue on his rampage to a whole other city. And he travels to Thebes to capture it, just to have more control. And there's another tower there where all the leaders of Thebes flee to this tower. And as he approaches it with bramble to set it aflame, a woman atop the tower drops a stone and crushes his head from top of the tower. And apparently he didn't fully die when the stone fell on his head. He was still somewhat alive, but he knew the shame of the death from a woman. And so he immediately asked his servant to kill him because he knew the immense shame. And he was then killed by his servant out in this town of Thebes as he was seeking more and more and more power. And this is the story of Abimelech. It is really awful. It's a really terrible story. It really doesn't end with much hope. Really, at the end of this section, so verse 23, we saw that God had sent the evil spirit. And then in verse 57, and God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their head. Well, first, sorry, verse 56. God returned the evil of Abimelech, which he committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. So that's the only other mention of God in that passage, and basically showing that God was aware of what was happening, and he was in control of it. And so when we think and reflect on what this chaos and destruction truly was, we see this ugly, long chapter where it feels as though God is silent, but he is not absent. He has used this evil spirit to put conflict between two evil parties. It seems silent because in one little brief statement, verse 22, it says, Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. So imagine this awful king, and he's there for 3 years. 3 years will feel like an eternity under the reign of someone of this nature. And so the people may have felt as though God is absent. And so this judgment of the Lord really is unseen, and it's after a period of time. So it seems absent. Or it seems silent, that the Lord is silent. But also this judgment comes through their own human sin, through the outworking of their own sin, that their greatest sin is what led to their greatest death. And that God truly in his judgment uses human rebellion against those who rebel, like using sin to destroy sin. And this can be a hard concept to understand, but I feel like Romans 1 is the best place to understand it, in that God's judgment is not just something waiting for us in the future, waiting for the world in the future. It is a present reality. And that his, in Romans 1:18, it says, for the wrath of God is revealed, present, is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. And so judgment of the Lord is something that is happening as God gives people over to their own sin. And we see that in Romans 1, three different times it says, therefore God gave them up. God gave them up. God gave them up. And the things that they were given up to were the lust of their heart, to dishonorable passions, and to a debased mind. And so all of those things are within a person, their heart, their passions, and their mind. He is giving them up to these things. And then the end of Romans 1 truly is a description of the story of Abimelech. That the people, once they've been given up, that the, and this being the revealed judgment of the Lord, they're filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice, envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They're gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. This is what we see in the present reality of God's judgment upon sin. It is people being given over to their own hearts. And what this shows, too, is that that process is like a slow decay. Dale Ralph Davis talked about, I guess in his childhood they had a basketball goal in his backyard, and I don't know if it was like, I don't know exactly the material of the goal, but apparently like over time it had been weathered and weathered and weathered and weathered and weathered, and then one day he was shooting the basketball and it hit the backboard and the whole backboard just smashed to the ground. It's because of the slow decay. You don't see the utter destruction for such a period of time. Like, the decay can take years and years and years and years. Yet, even amidst that, like, the Lord's judgment, his wrath is being revealed. And the having a debased mind does not necessarily happen overnight. It can be a slow, ugly process. And we see also in the reality of his wrath and judgment that he uses evil to destroy evil. At the end, I already read that verse at the end of chapter 9, just that he returned the evil to Abimelech and to the men of Shechem, that they basically received evil for the evil that they had already committed. And this, if we look back at verse 20, which at the end of the fable, this is what Jotham had said, but if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the leaders of Shechem, and let fire come out from the leaders of Shechem and devour Abimelech. That was the end of his curse, his fable, was that they're going to destroy each other. Evil's going to destroy evil. And that is exactly what happened in this story. And it is what will happen in the bigger story. In Revelation, you have these images of the beast and the prostitute, and the beast really being this picture of power, the power of the world, political, governmental power, and the picture of the prostitute being like prosperity and luxury and wealth. And what you see in Revelation 17 is their destruction of one another. And it says, the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. Wow. God has put it in their minds to basically destroy one another. And that is just before the marriage supper of the Lamb. Right? Like, this is the final destruction of the evil of the world, the evil destroying the evil. And again, quoting Del Ralph Davis, this saying, there is no fellowship in evil. Evil has no lasting cohesion. It does not care for its own. It only uses its own. And we see that in our world. Just people seeking to devour one another for more money, for more luxury, for more power. There is no mercy across nations, across political entities, all across the world. It is evil destroying evil, truly. And so this story ends pretty hopeless. That's the end of chapter 9. And I went ahead and was like, you know, we can't end like that. We need to just, we're just going to read the first 5 verses of chapter 10. Because it's like a little bit of like, okay, I can breathe. But all it says is, after Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Phua, son of Dodo, a man of Issachar, and he lived at Shamir in the hill country of Ephraim, and he judged Israel 23 years. Then he died and was buried at Shamir. Okay, so it just says, after Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola, and he was there 23 years. And then right after Tola, it just says there arose Jair, and Jair was there for 22 years, and then he died. So we basically have 45 years. And it just says that they arose and saved Israel after this horrific story. We don't get any other detail. What'd they do? How were they called by the Lord? How'd they save Israel? What did that look like to save Israel? Was there peace? Was there rest? We don't really know. Right? And Tim Keller made this really good point in his book. He said, who did Tola rise to save Israel from? It just says, Abimelech, there arose to save Israel, Tola. Who was he saving him from? Because in the past, like, Gideon saved him from the Midianites, right? Like, each story, they're saving them from some army, some people group. And Keller made the point to say, Tola saved Israel from itself. It had combusted. It had... people were turning upon one another within the people of Israel. And so Tola arose and saved Israel from itself, not from a group of people. Keller says, God's people ultimately need a leader who will rescue us from ourselves, from the failings and ambitions of our own hearts, and from the division and strife among us. And then I love this final quote from Del Ralph Davis, because Abimelech feels so awful to end. And Del Ralph Davis says, he does not allow blasting to go on forever, does not allow his people to be trampled ad infinitum. But it is his way, after the valley of the shadow, to anoint our heads with oil, after sorrow and sighing, to grant joy and gladness. Yahweh is the gracious God who never allows Abimelech to be the last word for his people. And that is truly the biggest takeaway, I would say, to have from the story of Abimelech. That the story of Abimelech is not the end of the story. And that even amidst this utter destruction, God saved Israel. And no explanation is needed. Just that God is merciful. And so with the ugliness of Abimelech and kind of thinking through what we discussed, I really would love to spend a good bit of time in discussion today. But at the beginning, we talked about that as the people lost love for the Lord and began worshiping other gods, they then mistreated people and lost love for people. So in what ways does loving God truly empower us to love others more fully?
I would say servant who perhaps is a million,
and
he went out, didn't fulfill his servant.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Separation of the relationship, or even the husband, or the baby, those small things that you have to look at.
Mm-hmm.
At least for me, like, you know, I don't remember that.
Yes.
Love them with those
quotes. Yes.
700 million.
Yes.
My girl's like, ugh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Like they're not your identity.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Mm-hmm. Understanding God's forgiveness and love. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's really good. No. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Anyone else have any thoughts on ways that loving God empowers us to love others? Uh-huh.
Of like all the
like God is love,
like,
and
like love one another. God is love, like overcome the world, because you love one another. And it's like it's just like I can't even count the number of times the word love.
Like, yeah.
And it's a teeny Bible.
Uh-huh.
It's so interesting like how closely God himself draws the parallel. Like if you truly understand my love for you, you have no way of not overflowing.
With
and
that love
is born out of God's love. It's not ours.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that he does really like to say that he empowers us to love others. It's his love. Just we can't hold it all in if we truly have any sort of grasp or understanding how much he loves us.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's the easy thing to show.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you love God because he loves you.
Yeah, yeah.
People love God because the greatest relationships we don't feel.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really great to be able to show it from the heart.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Your heart is loving God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you have never made these defend yourself and sort of protect yourself, right? Because God is like covering over you. It's like, no matter what I do to love, if it comes back with rejection, I'm still covered. Like
I'm not rejected. Yeah. Yeah, and I think in that, like, it can be so easy to just have, like, a slightly off where, like, you seek to love others first. And, like, in that, it can be such a subtle decay of, like, seeking their approval, seeking acceptance, seeking... so many, and you think, like, I don't know, it can be so subtle that you think you're, and it turns into this idolatry or this, because it's apart from loving God first. And it, I think it's just like an everyday coming before the Lord, first and foremost, like setting our hearts solely to Him. And like Danae said, in that it will overflow to others. But not putting the others first before him.
Well, yeah, it's like a sense of pride. I realized in the past, wait, taking God's love for me and pretending like I'm overflowing it to someone else, but really, I'm taking all the credit.
Right.
I love you really well.
Look at how good I love you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's like blasphemy almost. It's like, it's not mine. I didn't get it.
Yeah.
It comes from me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I'll take the praise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about people that come into your life and you just walk the wrong way, you just forget them, not be around them. And I think if you don't love the Lord, if you don't have the love of the Lord, it's impossible to look at that person and say, I'm going to love you.
Yeah, yeah, it's easier just to write someone off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so just like the people were more prone to wanting just some powerful leader instead of the Lord, where are we prone to want something more than the one who provides it? And then that Abimelech that kind of forced his way into power. He just kind of made it happen on his own accord. So what happens when we also try to force our own way instead of patiently waiting and trusting? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Trying to create it yourself. Yeah, it's like, why do we want the wealth? For security, for comfort, for, yeah, like, what is it that we're really seeking? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And, like, you can so desperately want something. Maybe it's a kind of claiming that you want to reach the world for kind people. Like, let's
uh-huh.
be saying to
them. Yeah.
Which sounds great to anybody who calls themselves a believer.
Uh-huh.
But if you don't really want the Lord, like, if you don't really have, like, as a leadership figure, you don't have accountability, if you don't have somebody who can commit to the discipleship, like, if you don't have those, you will get on the same path.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's just, it unfolds so clearly in the world as people avoid it.
Uh-huh.
But to see it in real time is so hard. And, I mean, thousands
yeah.
of people were completely blindsided. Like, they had no idea
mm-hmm.
what was really going on because it was such a big thing.
Yeah.
And I think in, like, in a leadership setting, it's so important, even if you don't work for a church, like, no matter where you were, if you call yourself a leader, you take that identity with you, and you take that intrinsically, and the reputation of that is
yeah.
no matter what you do. Yeah. So, like, knowing that the mission factor is like to go at the forefront, instead of trying to, well, I'm just helping this person, whatever you are, you're not just that thing. You have to still want those person's present in your life, and you're in your home, or, you know, wherever.
Mm-hmm.
Because things all hurt.
Yeah.
No matter what you are.
Right. There are repercussions.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
More people.
Yeah.
It is, but for some reason it just hit me. It's like, oh, yeah. It's like, if I'm not careful, or
mm-hmm.
I'm going to
fit.
If I
wreck
in my
people,
life,
yes.
Really, yeah, then I really
yeah.
But then, for me personally, I was, you know, got married 11 years ago. This kind of took that time to figure out how to live life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have not gone, like, really started jumping back in ministry until recently. And since my freshman year, I'm doing that.
Uh-huh. Has it been redirected?
Where does the Lord want me to be involved?
Uh-huh.
And where do I want to get involved so that people know that I'm doing it?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's on display.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so Tom Lewis and I.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I don't have that. And I know, like, I mean, there's a few people who take me to and I've been there personally myself. I've been part of
Yeah, that's good. Where am I doing something because the Lord has called me to it, and where am I doing something to be seen for it? That's really good. Okay, so can you reflect on a time or season in your life where the Lord allowed you to experience His judgment? It's like Romans 1. Or you were being given over. Or you could reflect back upon that. And also thinking of it as like His discipline, I guess, like, I think it's kind of both and. His judgment, to get to experience his judgment here is a blessing. To not experience it at the throne. I would much rather experience it here on earth than at the throne. And it is discipline. His judgment is discipline. Good, loving discipline. So I don't know if anything comes to mind for y'all or how it sanctified you. Self-glory, yeah. Out of that. A lot. Frequently. Yeah, maybe that was more like a First Peter trial, tested genuineness of your faith,
yeah,
like being refined like gold, you know?
But it was.
Maybe more in the trial era. I'm going to do this big ministry. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a difference in, like, trial, suffering, judgment, wrath. Like, it's kind of, it can discipline. There's definitely differences in it. I do feel like I experienced his judgment, his wrath, the Romans 1. In my being given over, in my past in homosexuality, and it was very, the being given over was like a slow decay. You know, there was like a lot of conviction at the beginning, and then over time the conviction became less and less, and the justification became more and more, and like my mind was being transformed to a debased mind, to like give approval to those who do it. And when he redeemed me from it, the fact that I think it was a gift that he let me get that far to experience his wrath, because now in a redeemed state, I think I can connect more with people that are in various levels of being given over. And like relating to their ideologies and their thought processes, and I think it was a gift that I experienced his wrath in that, and his amazing mercy to redeem me from it, because it would have just been a continued judge's spiral, you know. So I do believe that was his wrath, not just like a trial. Not just discipline. Like, I truly believe it was wrath, judgment. And I'm so grateful I experienced it here.
Mm-hmm. Like just all the way down to the dregs, and like mm-hmm. that like speaks to me like what's going on, what comes in my head. But in my own life, I really see so much of God just like being like a hidden.
Uh-huh. Oh.
Like to me, like that's what God is doing. Is He's holding back.
Yeah.
And like maybe there's like a little
coming through. Like, yeah.
A few, and I just get like a couple of. It hurts so bad, you know, I'm like, I can't do this back. And like, in my life, I feel like so much of it is like, I'm so generous, and He protects me
mm-hmm.
from so much wrath. But it is, sin has to be dealt with. If He's not going to allow, just like the Bible says, if He doesn't allow His children mm-hmm. to tell themselves,
mm-hmm.
He doesn't hate sin.
Yeah.
He brought you back from it, it so like, to let you just be like, sin, I kind of been a father.
So merciful.
It is so merciful, and it is not to reverse the story to the time of the same while
we had some good girl talk.
For this briefest moment to become like this isn't so like earlier in the summer, I would have if you'd asked me back in maybe April or May, if you would ask me like, hey, do you plan on working at this point? How long do you plan on working at your job? I was like, forever. I'm going to retire here. Like, this is where I'm going to be until I'm 60 years old and can't lift weights anymore. Like, and then I'm probably going to retire and then still teach people how to lift weights and, like, get healthy and exercise. And, like, literally, you know, it was in the middle of my life. So, I have had to, like, deal with that in a very unique way, right? Because I think, again, still with me from the neck down for a second here, in a lot of ways, I kept the belief. Just for like a half a second, and then I stopped and I thought about it and I was like, When has God ever allowed something to happen to me because He did it?
Right. Maliciously.
You know, like, He's been so merciful so many times in my life. And I've seen in other instances where, like, my relationship with the Lord is really like God just, like, reaches over and just, like, pushes me aside to steer me and just pulls me back. And I'm just always standing there like, can I just, like, get a... Like, can I just sit in the driver's seat, like, just for a second? Like, if we just go this way, it'll be quicker. And, like, that's my relationship with the Lord. I've learned that. And it is so hard to be the stubborn child. But, like, I've seen Him take over my plans that I had perfectly set.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, when I graduated from undergrad, I had a 5-year plan of how I was going to go through grad school and how my parents would retire early and, like, get me housing for them. Like, I had it. And I didn't even get a good enough grade in my GRE to, like, go to grad school. So it was like...
wait, my plan!
Wild. Like, yeah. Wild. So, like, just seeing the Lord do yet another thing in my life where I have to trust that He's sanctifying me. And now, only a few months later,
mm-hmm.
only a few months later do I now already see so much fruit from it in my own life and in my opportunity to share the Word with other people who are, I think... more of the right than I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it is so true. It's God's answer to the way of
mm-hmm.
and love covers up most of these things. But in this case, I don't believe that my love is covering most of these things. Mm-hmm. I have to believe that God's love has covered my idolatry. Mm-hmm. In my workplace, in this place, that is no longer ministering. And I wasn't using it. I was using it to minister to other people in my own power. I was going to do that. And it wasn't, I wasn't even in a ministry position. I was a coach.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it was a place that I could minister to people, but I just didn't have enough time anymore. I stopped selling to living. Like, I didn't have a really good seller. But, like, I couldn't do any discipleship.
Mm-hmm.
I could barely make it to church on Sundays. And I see the chat, see the lighting in the middle of the sermon. And I actually felt like I had to look at it. Like, I felt like I had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I had to finish working on Saturday. I had to do emails and phone calls on Saturdays. Like, I felt so obligated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what we're talking about.
Right.
I'm not called to sell my soul.
No, to a job.
And it doesn't matter where I live or why I initially signed up.
Mm-hmm.
It's like knowing that the Lord uses all things at any point in time to be like, how can you convenience make the mark of this?
Right.
He used it because he knows his best. I don't.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm the only one who gets distracted in the running to
right.
God's plan. And me looking at it, I'm the only person who's like, what I've changed is that like, this would be like a better way to do it. I'm the only person who gets that. So, I think even just like since this summer and again in the fall, like this is the first time I'm working on it. It's like it's just like a whirlwind. It's so in control, and it really is. It's making me have to sit down and go, so how am I going to do it?
And you never, ever, ever would have planned this to marry.
Yeah, you would have never written that.
That would be crazy. But
yeah.
Mm-hmm. He works so great.
Yeah.
Like at our own
time. Yeah, it's such a better story. Yeah.
It would be great when he pulls the rug out that immediately takes a big sigh and helps.
Oh, look what you're doing!
Yeah.
Yay!
We have
to
go to the top.
Yeah. Yeah.
My
yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing all that today. Yeah.
It's so awesome.
First of November, yep. Okay, well, how can we recognize our tendency for slow decay in our spiritual lives? And we may have already talked about this a little bit, but any other thoughts about the decaying backboard?
Accountability.
Oh, that's good.
Having people that are close to you that
can recognize something that's off or challenge you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Accountability. That's good.
Which is something I struggle at. I mean, I don't need anyone else.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it's the body of the people. Mm-hmm. So in what ways do we need to be saved from ourselves? Like the people of Israel. Everyone. Yeah. I think it's so, as I reflect back on like all my craziness, it's like, yeah, the issue was never someone else. I didn't need to be saved from something or some person or from some job or from some terrible experience I had. Like, it was me. I needed to be saved from me. And it's so easy to kind of say, like, oh, it was that job. That job's what did it. Or it was because I went to Duke. You know, they have different ideologies over there. You know, it's like, no, it wasn't those things. It was me. So...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 It's like the daily cry for Psalm 51. To wash me thoroughly, to create in me a clean heart. It's like, it's not a one-time create in me a clean heart. It's like, Lord, today. Today, wash me thoroughly. Every day. And tomorrow, I'm gonna cry out to you again and with Psalm 51. Yeah. It was right before I came.
I can't remember exactly, but I just remember going through that every day and thinking about it and realizing sometimes that I could no longer say, like, God, you know, help me follow you to my future, or just, God, help me follow you.
Like a vague prayer.
Right. Yeah. It became, God, help me follow you today and bring me back right here tomorrow. Like, that's as far as I could make.
Yeah. Day by day. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Help me today.
Or like something that I'm just habitually, like, it's just conditioned at this point. And so, like, or like my time with the Lord just goes.
That's good.
Spend time with the Lord. It's one of those things that's like, you have to kind of do back and forth. That's how you get things involved. Knowing what's been off for longer. Like, it's missing here.
Something's off.
Allow them to teach me a lot. There's no such thing as something like that. I'm in high school. It's all the time. There's no, like, there's no amount of cooking that you can do at the same time that you've been going at for a while. If you take your foot off the gas and you're here for life and you're thinking of godliness and you're here for discipline, if you take your foot off the gas, you will slow down and you will have to take it.
The compromises.
Like, shifting into myself and, like, making space and then, like, I thought about a few times, I forgot I'm going to take space today. So there's another thing that, like, if he's not on the top of the priority list, he's not.
It's a decay. Yeah, there will be decay.
That he's not the center.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully from Abimelech's story, we can see the realities of the decay, the being given over, and the realities of, like, the Lord's unmerited grace and mercy towards us to save us even in the ugliness. So I'm going to close this in a word of prayer. We're a little bit over on our time. Sorry about that, guys. But I'll pray for us, and then we can head. Father, we just thank you so much that we can learn from your word, Lord, even in the passages that are hard to read and hard to process, Lord, that we can see your holiness, that we can see your justice and your mercy and your love. Lord, we ask that you would hold us, that you would keep our eyes fixed upon you, that you would keep our feet upon your path, that each day we would wake up seeking your face alone, that that you would keep us from decay, that you would keep us surrounded by accountability, by people that know us, that can see us, and that would help us to grow in you. Lord, please fill us with your love, that we can love others around us. And Lord, we just ask for your protection this week for all these women, for their hearts, that they would seek after you each day, that they would meditate upon your word throughout the day, and that they would be mighty vessels for your kingdom. We ask all these things in your Son's name. Amen.